You are listening to a message by Pastor David Guzik for Enduring Word. For more information about our ministry, please visit enduringword.com.
Now, the book of Esther is the last historical book of the Old Testament. Old Testament history ends with the book of Esther. Some of the minor prophets prophesied after the time of Esther, but that's not history, that's the prophets. The history of the Old Testament ends with the book of Esther. And she has a wonderful name that's appropriate to the book. The name Esther means the morning star. And you know, one of the things about the planet Venus, which is known as the morning star, is that it's the star that shines when all the other stars have faded in their sight. If there's one star you can see in the morning, it's the planet Venus, which isn't a star actually, but it shines as if it were a star. You can see that shining out in the morning sky. And you could say this, that the deeds of Queen Esther cast a ray of light forward into Israel's history from a very, very dark time. Because the dark time that the story of Esther comes from is the time when the people of God were in exile. Let me sort of set the stage for it. You see, after the reigns of King Saul, King David, and King Solomon, the 12 tribes of Israel eventually became two kingdoms, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. The northern kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians somewhere around 720 BC. And then the southern kingdom of Judah was conquered by the Babylonians somewhere around 586 BC. And when these kingdoms were conquered, they didn't go in there and slaughter all the people of Israel or slaughter all the people of Judah. But what they did was they took away all but the poorest of the poor. The poorest of the poor they would leave behind. But everybody else, they carried them away into exile. They made them refugees by force, and they were relocated to the other cities of the Middle East. So the story of the book of Esther deals with the Jewish exiles that lived in the kingdom or the empire, whatever you want to call it, the kingdom or the empire of Persia under the reign of King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus is more famously known to history as King Xerxes, who was famous for his battles against the Greeks and the Greek empires. You see, but at this time, at the time that the book of Esther takes place, the Persian Empire was the greatest empire that the world had ever seen. It covered today, if you were to look at a map, it covered Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Pakistan and Jordan and Lebanon and Israel and parts of what is modern-day Egypt, Sudan, Libya, and Arabia. It was a massive empire, and the Jews were scattered throughout the Persian Empire. Well, the book of Esther begins with a big feast in the court of King Ahasuerus. Or actually, it was a series of three royal feasts. And during one of these royal feasts, the king commanded that his queen, the queen's name was Vashti, the queen was supposed to appear before the drunken partiers in some adornment or lack of adornment that would just simply be called immodest. And to her credit, out of pauper dignity, Queen Vashti said, "No way. I'm not going to sacrifice my dignity in front of these drunken partiers. No way, king. I'm not going to do it." Well, the king became furious at this, and he deposed Queen Vashti of her position. So what did they do? They had to replace the queen. So they had an empire-wide beauty pageant. I don't know if it was more of a beauty pageant or a talent show. I don't know if it was the Persian Idol contest of their day or whatever you want to call it. But they were looking for a replacement queen. And I don't know if the contestants all volunteered, or maybe they were just kind of shanghaied wherever they could find a beautiful woman in the kingdom. We don't really know, but they simply brought the most beautiful women all across the Persian Empire to be part of this contest. And one way or another, this Jewish woman, a beautiful Jewish woman named Esther, became part of the competition. Now, Esther was born in Persia, but her parents grew up in Judah and were exiled across the Persian Empire. Her mother and father died when she was young, so she was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And her Jewish name is Hadassah, which means myrtle, as in a myrtle tree. But her Persian name was Esther, which basically means star or morning star. Now, we're told, and this is in Esther chapter 2, verse 7, that Esther was, quote, lovely and beautiful, which literally means, and I can say this because I'm a Bible commentator, it literally means that she had a good figure and she had pretty features. I mean, she had the entire package, so to speak. And willingly or unwillingly, she became part of the whole contest. And she entered the harem of the Persian king. Now, basically, when she came into the harem of the Persian king, she enjoyed about a year's worth of daily spa treatments before she was even allowed to even meet the king. Now, you know, for most women, going to the spa is like a special occasion. You get that thing for Mother's Day or your birthday or anniversary or something, and you go and it's a big deal. Listen, Esther lived a year of spa treatments. They probably didn't have that little rocks that they put on their back. I don't even know what the thing is with the rocks that they put on their back. It doesn't even sound pleasant to me. But whatever they had, she had it. Matter of fact, I'll tell you, it was even better for her because God even gave her favor with the men who supervised the harem. And she got special spa treatments, you know, the upgrade package, and 7 special assistants to look after her every need. Now, if she was beautiful before, imagine how she looked coming out of a year of daily spa treatments. Now, you think, man, what could possibly be better than to be one of the women in this harem with these wonderful people just fawning over you and preparing you every day? Well, I tell you, the destiny of these women should also be considered. What these women had, and there were 400 women in the entire pool of contestants. What these 400 women basically had was one night with the king. That's it. And after that one night with the king, if he chose the one out of the 400 to be his queen, then she would be his companion until she pulled a Vashti and he deposed her. But as for the 399 who lost, they would be banished to the harem where they would stay either the wife or the concubine of the king of Persia forever, but probably rarely, if ever, see him afterwards. They were never free to marry another man, and they essentially lived the rest of their lives as perpetual widows. So if you were the one who won among the 400, that's pretty great. But for the 399, it was a pretty miserable existence for the rest of your life. Now, all the time that Esther was in this year of these special spa treatments, she never revealed that she was Jewish. And her cousin Mordecai, who worked for the king in some way, he kept constant contact with her. And eventually, she had her appointment with the king. And it says, Esther 2:17, that the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. The idea is this, is that the king saw more than just her beauty. He saw her character. He saw what an amazing woman she really was. She was a good woman. Now, sometime after this, Esther's cousin Mordecai uncovered a plot to assassinate the king. So he told Esther, who warned the king, and then the plot was exposed. The guilty men were executed, and a record of the whole thing was made in the Chronicles of the Kingdom of Persia. Kind of put that off onto the side. So Esther's the queen, Mordecai saves the king from an assassination plot, and then there's another character who comes on the scene. So far we have the king, we have Queen Esther, we have Mordecai, her cousin, but now a fourth character comes on the scene. His name is Haman. He rose to prominence in the kingdom as well. And Haman was promoted to the second highest place in all of the kingdom of Persia after the king himself. And everybody bowed down before him to show their fear and respect. Everybody bowed down before Haman except for one man. Can you guess who that was? Mordecai the Jew. You see, Mordecai the Jew thought, for whatever reason, bowing down before Haman would be a display of idolatry. And he said, no way, I'm having nothing to do with that. Now, you know what's interesting about it? At first, Haman didn't even notice that one man was standing. I don't know if he stood by a pillar. I don't know if he stood by a post against a wall. But at first, Haman himself didn't see that it happened to be Mordecai standing. He didn't notice anybody. But you know what? His advisors pointed him out. Hey, do you notice there's a guy who stands and he doesn't bow down before? Haman said, what? There's somebody who doesn't bow down? Now listen, this is what's funny about it. As soon as Haman found out that there wasn't a guy bowing down, one man standing, who do you think he saw every time he was out? His eyes were instantly drawn to the one guy not bowing down, and it started to drive Haman a little bit crazy. Matter of fact, you could say that Haman was crazy with anger. He was so proud and so angry that he decided in his heart, I am going to kill not just Mordecai, I'm going to launch a plot to kill all the Jews of the kingdom of Persia. Now, by the way, there were more Jews in the kingdom of Persia at that time than any other kingdom on earth. If you were to kill all the Jews in the kingdom of Persia, you wouldn't wipe out every last Jew on the face of the earth, but probably 70 or 80% of them. It would have been a devastating blow to the Jewish people. So he thought, how am I going to execute this plan? And you know what he did? He said, I'm going to cast lots to determine when I should do this. And so he went and either rolled a dice or picked out a lucky thing or rubbed a rabbit's foot. I don't know exactly what it was. But when the lot came back, it said, carry this plot out in 11 months' time. And that's what he determined to do. So Haman deceived King Ahasuerus into passing a law that allowed the Jews to be massacred and to have all their property stolen in 11 months' time. Now, when the Jewish community of Persia heard about this, what do you think the reaction was? They were absolutely filled with sorrow. They understood that a law went on the books that in 11 months' time, they would all be executed, they would all be wiped out, and all of their property would be confiscated. They were filled with sorrow. They mourned, they fasted, they prayed. And Mordecai challenged Queen Esther to do something about it. After all, the queen of the entire kingdom is Jewish, and the king doesn't even know that she's Jewish. So Mordecai says to Esther, do something. Go and talk to the king and get him to change this law. And you know what Esther said in response? Are you crazy? She said, I haven't seen the king for a whole month. And by the way, she was the winner and she didn't see the king for a whole month. I haven't seen the king for a whole month and I'm not allowed to go into his presence without an invitation. If I go into the king's presence without an invitation, he'll kill me. I'm done. This is how it works among the Persians. Then Mordecai said to Esther some of the most memorable words in the entire book of Esther. Do you remember these words? From Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Turn there in your Bibles. Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. These might be the two most memorable verses of the whole book of Esther. Ready for this? And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Esther heard that challenge from Mordecai. First of all, it was a warning. Esther, you're Jewish. I know you haven't revealed it to the king, but he'll find out. Don't think that you're going to escape. When the command goes out to massacre all the Jews, you're going to go down too. Secondly, please remember that God put you in your unique position for such a time as this. Take courage and do something. Well, that's exactly what Esther did. She took courage from the challenge of Mordecai, and she said to her cousin, if you can get the people of God to fast and to pray for me, then I'll do it. So after 3 days of fasting and prayer support, Esther put on her best clothes, and she made herself up just right. I don't know, maybe when she went back to the spa for a couple of days. And she walked right into the king's inner court. Now, at that moment, when the king saw her come in without an invitation, he could give her either a death sentence or he could show mercy to her. And he finally held out his royal scepter, represented by this bottle of water. He held out his royal scepter, indicating mercy instead of judgment. Can you imagine how nerve-wracking that was for Esther? She comes in with her heart beating like crazy, knowing that this is a man who got rid of queens like he was changing his underwear. And now he sees her coming in, and what does he do? It's either going to be thumbs down or thumbs up. You're either going to die or you're going to live. And he sees her, and for whatever reason, well, we know it was the work of God behind the scenes, of course. He holds out the scepter as an indication of mercy. And he says, Esther, my dear queen, what do you want? Now, the wheels are turning inside Esther's head. And I don't know if she had it all planned out or not, but you would have think she would have because it was such a clever thing to do. She didn't say, oh, please save the Jewish people. No, she didn't say any of that. All she said to the king was, I want you and Haman to come to a banquet tonight. Now, how could the king pass that up? So she made that invitation, and the king and Haman came at the banquet that night. When they were at the banquet, the king said, okay, Esther, I know you're my wife, you're the queen. What do you want? You know, I know you weren't just going to invite me to a banquet. What is it? And you know what she said? She said, I want you to come to another banquet tomorrow night. I don't know, maybe she was just hungry or something. But here she was making all these plans and inviting them to a banquet the second night. I don't know. I get the feeling, and I can't prove it, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Maybe she was afraid to share her real request. Maybe she was afraid to say this. Dear king and husband, you have been tricked into making a stupid law that means that I and all the Jewish people will be killed. You need to change this stupid law right away. Now remember, up to this point, nobody knew that Esther was Jewish. So after the first banquet, but before the second banquet, Haman went home. Now Haman was on top of the world at this time. He was second in the kingdom, and now he's getting invited to special dinners with the king and the queen. Friends, it doesn't get any higher than that. This isn't like a state dinner where there's a lot of people, a lot of crowds. No, this is a special dinner. You've got the king, the queen, and Haman. You cannot possibly be higher in the mightiest empire on the earth at that time. And so he's feeling so good about this. But there was one thing that did not allow him to fully enjoy all the status, all the prestige he had. What was it? He's walking home and everybody's bowing down before him, except for what? Except for Mordecai the Jew. And you know what? This Haman fellow is a twisted man. He can't enjoy everything that he has. But rather, the displeasure of one person makes him say, I'm miserable, I can't live with this anymore, what am I going to do? And he complained like a baby about this to all of his friends. And you know what his friends said? His friends, ever helpful, said something like this. Well, just kill him. Make a gallows. You know what a gallows is? It's a big wooden structure where they hang them from the neck. Just make a gallows 75 feet high and stick him on it. Now that made Haman happy again. He got happy at the idea of seeing Mordecai swinging from a 75-foot gallows. So he commanded the gallows to be built, and then he says, great, we'll do it tomorrow. Now, the night before the second banquet, so it's the night after the first banquet, okay, that night, but before the second banquet, the king couldn't sleep. I want you to think about that. The king couldn't sleep. He's the master of 127 provinces, but he can't master 10 minutes of sleep. And so there he is, awake at night, turning upon his bed. He's bored, and he asks somebody to come in and read to him. It's just a little bit funny. You wonder, is he 5 years old? No, he just asks somebody to come in and read to him. So the reader comes in and picks out one of the volumes of the Chronicles of the Kingdom of Persia, and he opens it up, and he starts reading. And where does he start reading? He just so happened to start reading where it recorded the story of Mordecai saving King Ahasuerus from the assassination attempt. And Ahasuerus says, man, I like this story. One of my loyal subjects saved me from being assassinated. There was a plot to kill me, and he exposed it. And he goes, the guy reads it, and he reads the story, and I said, man, this is a great story. I love this one. And then he stops, wait a minute. What did we do for the guy who uncovered the assassination attempt? And the chronicler looks through the record again and goes, well, it doesn't say we did anything. The king instantly realizes, this is bad news. When people uncover assassination attempts against me, I want them to be rewarded. I want to give a good motivation for people to uncover assassination attempts against me. So he goes, oh man, this is really, really bad. We got to do something to reward Mordecai. So just then, in the middle of the night, the king says this, who's around here anyway? Who is in the king's court? Just then, who happened to enter the king's court? Haman. He had just come from supervising the construction of the 75-foot gallows, and he's happy as anything. He's whistling a tune, walking on his way home. He's so happy because he can just picture Mordecai swinging from that 75-foot gallows, and he's walking through the king's court, and then suddenly they say, hey, wait a minute, the king wants to see you right away. And so he gets ushered into the king's presence, and there's the king in his nightshirt and his nightcap, and he asks Haman, he goes, Haman, what should I do for the one that I really want to reward? Now, who's the king thinking about? Mordecai. Who's Haman thinking about? Haman. So Haman gets these visions of sugar plums dancing in his head, and he goes, oh man, the king loves me so much. I am so great that he's asking me what kind of bonus. You know, he said, Haman, create your own bonus. That's what he thinks. The invitation is something like this. And so, thinking that the king wanted to honor him, Haman said this. Well, king, if you really want to reward someone, and then he starts acting out all the fantasies he's ever had. First, put the king's robe on him. And then let him ride the king's horse all through the city square with a noble prince shouting before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king wants to reward. All the while, Haman could just see himself with that robe on the horse being praised in the city square. So what did the king say after Haman made that suggestion? It's one of the best parts. The king says, Haman, that's a great idea. I want you to find this guy Mordecai, put my robe on him, put him on the horse, and lead him throughout the city square. You should be the one to announce him to everyone. Man, I tell you, I cannot wait to get the DVD of that in heaven. Or whatever digital technology they have that surpasses that. It'll be holograms by then, won't it? I don't know. And to see the look on Haman's face. But Haman had to do it. The king told him to do it. And it was his own suggestion. It was the most horrible day of Haman's life. He had to publicly honor the man that he hated so much. And he came home from that feeling lower than he ever had before. He comes home feeling, I am never going to see Mordecai swinging from those gallows. He comes home thinking, I had to be humiliated in front of this man that I wanted him to be humiliated before me. On and on. There's nothing he can think about what can make this day worse. When suddenly, after he gets home, he hears a knock at the door. And what does the knock at the door say? The knock at the door says, hey, it's time to go to the second banquet tonight. You forgot about the second banquet, didn't you? Well, the king didn't forget about it. The queen didn't forget about it. I think Haman might have forgot about it, but hurriedly, he gets himself ready, and then he goes to the second banquet that Esther had asked for. So at the second banquet, all three of them are together again. The king's there, the queen's there, and Haman. And the king asked Esther again, all right, baby, what do you want? Tell me what you want. And this is what she says. Ahasuerus, please don't kill me. Somebody wants to kill me and all of my people. Now, if they just wanted to sell us as slaves, I wouldn't have said anything. But because they want to kill us, I need your help. Can you imagine how angry King Ahasuerus was to hear that there was somebody who wanted to kill his wife? The king was amazed, and he asked the most logical question. What do you think the logical question would be? Who wants to kill you? And what did Esther do? She pointed at Haman. Let me tell you something. Haman's bad day just got worse. You know what's funny? It's even going to get worse than this. The king was so furious because right then he figured out that Haman had tricked him. The king was so furious that he left the room just to calm down and gather his thoughts. Haman started blubbering and begging for mercy before Queen Esther, and he was so disturbed that he fell across the couch where Esther was sitting. Just then, the king walked back into the room, and what did he see? He sees Haman lying over Queen Esther. And then he says, is Haman going to attack the queen even while I'm in the same room? And they prepared Haman for execution, and they put him on the same gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Now, because of the Persian laws, the king couldn't change the law that he made about massacring the Jews. They had a custom among the Persians that once the king makes a law in a special way, you can't change it. But, what he did was something different. He could pass a second law allowing the Jews to be armed and to defend themselves. And he did all that. And when the day came for the Jews to be massacred, the only ones who end up getting killed were the ones who tried to attack the Jewish people. It was a great deliverance for the Jewish people. And so they remembered it with the holiday that we call today Purim. I want you to think about this. Just as Passover remembers the deliverance from Egypt, so Purim remembers the deliverance from the massacre, from the genocide, you could say, in the kingdom of Persia during the days of Esther. And I want you to think about those two kinds of deliverance side by side. You can have an Exodus kind of deliverance, or you can have an Esther kind of deliverance. The Exodus kind of deliverance is filled with supernatural signs. Man, there's lice and lightning and fire and this and that and the other thing. All kinds of supernatural signs in the Exodus deliverance. In the Esther deliverance, virtually no supernatural signs. But friends, don't you agree that God was no less active in the Esther deliverance than he was in the Exodus deliverance? You see, God did his work in Esther in a very natural, behind-the-scenes kind of way. Now, did you know that there's some people who don't like the book of Esther? You know one of the reasons why they don't like the book of Esther? Because they read the book of Esther and they notice something. And I have to admit, this is something curious about the book of Esther. The name of God is not mentioned once in the entire book of Esther. Doesn't that blow your mind? The name of God is not mentioned once in the entire book of Esther. But people who are upset with the book of Esther about that, I don't think they truly understand the book. Because even though God's name may not appear in the book, friends, his hand is all over the book. Think about everything that God arranged in the book of Esther. God arranged for the noble queen Vashti to lose her place. God arranged for there to be a competition to replace Queen Vashti. God arranged for Esther to enter the competition. God arranged for Esther to have special favor among the other women. God arranged for Mordecai to have access to Esther and to the affairs of the kingdom. God arranged for the lot that was cast to give 11 months. You know, if it had given 1 month, all the Jews would have been massacred. God arranged that the decree commanding that the Jews be killed happened by private hands instead of by the army of Persia. You know, it would have been very difficult for the Jewish people to beat back the Persian army, but all they had to beat back was private individuals. God arranged that Haman would restrain his anger and not kill Mordecai immediately. God arranged for Esther to delay her request, first asking for a banquet and then asking for a second banquet. God arranged for Haman's anger to come to a peak on one particular day. God arranged for Ahasuerus to have a sleepless night. God arranged for Ahasuerus to pick up one particular book and open up the one particular place. And God arranged for Ahasuerus to read the passage about Mordecai in that particular book. You might even say that the book of Esther is a very powerful illustration in the Old Testament of that great passage from Romans chapter 8, verse 28. Romans 8, 28, you know it, don't you? Ready? And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. Isn't that the whole theme of the book of Esther? So that's one thing that it shows us, is that God is arranging things all the time. Let me tell you a second thing that the book of Esther tells us. The book of Esther tells us this. It tells us that God's hand in history never rules out our actions. Friends, the actions of Esther and Mordecai were critical to the preservation of the people of God. You can't just look and say, well, no matter what Mordecai did, the people of God would have been preserved. No matter what Esther did, no, God used the actions of both Esther and Mordecai to preserve his people. I think it's amazing to see that God's will was accomplished, but check it out. Everybody was perfectly free to do whatever they wanted to do. Haman did as he pleased. Ahasuerus did what he wanted. And so did Mordecai, and so did Esther. We see no interference. God is not coercing them to do anything. They all did their will, and they bear full responsibility for it. And yet God was working out his eternal plan of the ages through it all. The third thing we see is this, is that God, in his wise and providential plan, he allows his people to be tested. You might say this, David, if God is so in control of everything that he can even affect the sleepless night of a king to accomplish his purpose, if God is so in control over everything, why didn't he just control it to where this threat never happened? But friends, God allows his people to be tested, and sometimes severely so. We should not suppose that the servants of God are going to be protected from every trial because the trials are part of God's design. Friends, this was a great trial for Mordecai. He refused to bow to Haman when others would suffer for it because he refused to give homage to Haman. But it was also a great trial for Esther because she heard the news of the great coming slaughter of her people and she had to boldly approach the king. No, God allows his people to be tested. It also shows us two other things. It shows us, and this is number four, it shows us the principle of a greater law. Friends, the law of the Persian king could not be changed. Neither can the law of God. The law of God cannot be changed. Ahasuerus could not change his law, condemning and bringing death to the Jewish people. But you know what he could do? He could make a greater law that would allow them to defend themselves. Do you understand that that is exactly what God has done in our salvation? He didn't take away the law that condemns us as sinners, but he made a greater law of righteousness received in Jesus Christ that allows us to be saved. And then finally, we see that the story of Esther shows us something about Jesus. Where's Jesus in the book of Esther? Okay, what's Esther's name mean? Morning star? Is there not a title for Jesus that he is the bright and morning star? Did not God have a deliverer for his people, just as Esther was the deliverer for the people of God in the Persian Empire? And do we not, as believers, have an advocate before the throne of God? Every Jew in Persia felt hope when they knew, I have a friend that is that close to the throne. And friends, every person here can have the hope of knowing you have a friend in Jesus right there at the throne of God, praying for and interceding for you. He is your deliverer, the bright and the morning star.
You've been listening to a message by Pastor David Guzik for Enduring Word. For more information about our ministry and how to grow in your relationship with Jesus, please visit enduringword.com.